Well, welcome everybody. It's a great pleasure to introduce Kamari Clark to you. I'm very happy that she made all the way from Canada to us tonight to give a talk and tomorrow a reading seminar. I'd like to briefly introduce Kamari Clark. She is an associate professor at Carleton University in Canada in Global and International Studies, and also teaches in the departments of Law and Legal Studies as well as in the Anthropology department there. She's trained in Canada and the US and was formerly a professor in Yale University, the University of Pennsylvania, and the University of Toronto. Her research spans a broad area of topics, most importantly for us here tonight, topics like human rights, international courts and tribunals, the export, spread, rejection, and recontextualization of international norms, secularism and religious transnationalism, the United Nations and African Unity Treaty negotiations, as well as Africa's insertions into international law circuits. Thus, her work has focused on questions and theoretizations of culture, power, and injustice, law and legal pluralism, aesthetics and politics, as well as social and political theory. As an Africanist scholar, she has conducted extensive fieldwork in Nigeria, Kenya, and Uganda, and has worked on institutionalized settings such as the International Criminal Court in The Hague and at the African Union. She's further served as an expert advisor to the African Union. Her numerous acclaimed publications include, for instance, Fictions of Justice, the International Criminal Court on the Challenge of Legal Pluralism in Sub-Saharan Africa, as well as, together with Mark Goodale, Mirrors of Justice, Law and Power in the Post-Cold War Era, both published with Cambridge University Press. Tonight, she's going to present as part of her recent research on the effective dimension of international criminal justice, which is something which we are very excited about as we have this new collaborative research center here on effective societies, where we are having a project on the effective dimension of justice in international criminal law as well. So we are very happy and excited to hear you give a talk tonight under the title Effective Justice and the Politics of Sentimentality, the International Criminal Court in Africa. Thank you for coming.
Okay, thank you for that introduction, and it's good to be back in Berlin. I see a few familiar faces in the audience, so I'm looking forward to the discussion. The material that I'll present today is part of a book in progress, a manuscript that I'm working on, and I certainly am interested in the engagement with colleagues here, in particular because of the work that you're doing on affects. And in my case, of course, sentimentality. So I look forward to feedback. Now, I suppose it's been since 98 working on the rise of the rule of law movement and the formation and institutionalization of the Rome Treaty that then became the ICC, or the treaty that governs the institution that is the International Criminal Court. And as I was mentioning to Jonas over coffee a while back, when I think about the genealogy and how I came to study affects and think about affects, in many ways it wasn't preordained. In many ways it had to do with taking seriously a set of questions that around which thinking about emotion had no space or vocabulary in the language of the law. And as one African leader after another was indicted by the court, and I interviewed my respondents, my interlocutors, there wasn't really a vocabulary within the structure of thinking through many of the political and legal questions that I posed for making sense of a whole set of other contradictions that were at play. Contradictory voting patterns, a range of other things that didn't quite make sense. And so over the last, I suppose it's been now 5 or 6 years, I've been involved in collecting data and writing this manuscript. Much of the work came from a 3-year National Science Foundation grant through the US government, one of the standard funders for anthropological work. And from that 3-year project, I then began writing up the material, analyzing, coding, and writing up the material. And so as far as research methods then, of course, the work reflects multi-sided work, institutional work, as well as a range of interviews, observations, participatory research with lawyers, human rights advocates, NGOs, judges, etc. So all as one would expect. But more precisely, and I think more important for our purposes and the material that I'll present today, is we conducted 200 interviews at the AU and at the ICC in The Hague. And in part, the goal here was to think about the forms of sentiment and the type of rationalities that were part of the ways that people explained questions of culpability, questions of what justice is and what it represents to them, and what it represents in relation to the law as well as in relation to other judicial or non-judicial mechanisms. So, of course, what we have then is in this research, two institutions around which a range of assemblages of actors are engaged, one, of course, being the court, and then the second being the African court. And one led to, or in many ways, was directly related to the other. And just the backstory on this is that, on one hand, what we have is the emergence of an African court with criminal jurisdiction. And so the last part of the project, after spending a year and a half or a year in The Hague, the second half involved working with the AU and mostly doing attending a number of their trainings, as well as doing advisory work for the legal office. The goal here, of course, and the larger goal, was to make sense of what justice is and the extent to which justice was perceivable and articulated through the language of the law, and what was outside of that, and how people perceived and understood this thing as amorphous as justice to become manifest. In the later stage of the project, we were quite interested in media campaigns. And especially among some of the younger students who worked on the project and were involved, the whole hashtag campaigns and the ways that these campaigns were at large. And so on one hand, we have this formal institution. On the other hand, we have the rise of particular modalities around which justice was being understood. And so I'm going to start with a discussion of these hashtag campaigns. Now, the analytic point of departure, I'll also foreground before I read the talk, is that of a concept that's in the larger book, which is affective attribution. And so through the talk, I'll simply make reference to it, but for the purposes of making sure that we're on the same page and I can clarify what I'm saying here, let me say that the way that I'm defining it in many ways builds on the ways that, for example, in psychology, attribution is seen as a process by which individuals explain the causes of behavior and events. And of course, in law, attribution is often referred to as the act of assigning a quality or feature that is inherent in one or in a thing. And in much of the larger book project, affective attribution for me is an attempt to study the processes by which paths to justice are understood and more centrally are contested. So it's these sites of contestation around which particular assemblages and nodes of justice are understood. And so, of course, I do this and I talk about affective attribution often in relation to a domain of reattribution. So the idea that often in these protest moments, in these moments of encounters, what you have are redeployments of meaning. And in the case of, for the purposes of this talk, the redeployment that I'm focusing on is that of time, legal time, so questions of temporality that are at play. And so this becomes one of the many, many sites for redeployments in which we see forms of sentimental or emotional articulations. And so this is what I'm doing here for with affective attribution. The other point that I won't really develop here, but I do in the larger manuscript, is the idea that it unfolds when people publicly protest the terms of justice. And so often and through much of the tropes that I'll uncover, what we're talking about are often reattributions, so ways of redesignating the nodes through which we understand justice. In spring 2012, the hashtag Kony 2012 campaign was everywhere. The group known as Invisible Children popularized the video entitled Kony 2012 that went viral. Within days, over 120 million had viewed it online, and household names like Bill Gates and celebrities such as Rihanna had retweeted it. Inspired by Jason Russell's travels, Kony 2012 narrates Uganda's 25-year-old war, its violence, and the consequences of that violence, the death and displacement of millions of Ugandans. The film connects Uganda's mass violence to Joseph Kony, the leader of the Lord's Resistance Army, and demands that he be held accountable judicially for the violence committed by the LRA. Russell's narration describes Kony as heading the Lord's Resistance Army, what he sees as a Christian terrorist group, which has reportedly abducted and forced more than 30,000 children to fight with them since the revolt began in 1986. He then disclosed, this is in the video, that his commitment was inspired by a promise that he made to a young boy named Jacob, a young Ugandan boy, whose brother was killed by Kony's men. Russell vowed that he was going to, quote, do everything possible to stop them. The rest of the story, end quote. The rest of the story, then, is about how American political participation and the stopping of a single leader will rectify Uganda's plight. Through the narrativizing of the primal relationship between Russell and his young son, he opened the second storyline with advice to him. Quote, there are good guys and bad guys in Africa. You all probably remember this. Russell's simplistic words about the nature of African violence and the role of ordinary Americans is catapulted with a compelling narrative about the conditions by which justice can be procured through international participation. This message resounded clearly that by donating money through a simple click of your mouse and buying a kit that will help fund Joseph Kony's arrest, every American can be part of the solution to help poor Ugandan victims. The simplicity of the Kony 2012 message seemed compelling and suggested that Africa can be transformed by our philanthropy through our willingness to save Ugandans. The campaign was one of a series of philanthropic, humanitarian, and justice-seeking gestures whose message was that capturing a single commander, a perpetrator responsible for mass crimes, will solve some of Africa's most endemic problems, that of violence. Ultimately, it led to the symbolic merger between stopping the perpetrator and mobilizing the law, through which both were seen as key domains for ending impunity. Through the symbolism of a judicial indictment on behalf of victims, the pro-accountability discourse about the perpetrator to be stopped at all costs loomed large. The modalities for procuring a world free of violence were effective because of the way they compelled sentimentality in the name of the victim. They have also become powerful because of the idea that no one should be beyond the law, that the individual perpetrator must be stopped if we are to end impunity once and for all. With these motivations, the Kony 2012 campaign contributed to the construction of an individual perpetrator whose alleged crimes aligned with the International Criminal Court's post-2002 threshold for temporal jurisdiction, a time determinant that I refer to here as legal time. Through the attribution of guilt to an individual for violence committed by groups of Ugandans over long years of social unrest, this popular campaign and their pro-accountability actions were featured by the promoters, and the longer histories of collective action were sidelined. Now, if hashtag 2012, Kony 2012, contributed to the popularization of a particular figure of the African perpetrator, understood through a prism of culpability measured in relation to a post-2002 period. In neighboring Kenya, a comparable campaign with opposite ideological commitments led to the rebuttal of the designation of Uhuru Kenyatta and William Ruto as perpetrators culpable for Kenya's post-2007-2008 violence. In their campaign, the notion of an African perpetrator was re-signified and reframed in relation to various modes of collective crimes situated in relation to the historical conditions of their making. Centered on the indictments of Kenyatta and Ruto by the ICC, both incumbents came together as presidential and deputy presidential contenders for the Kenyan federal elections. Their campaign, with its slick and compelling message, brought together two unlikely collaborators through the rebranding of the Kenyan nationalist narratives. Masterminded by a high-end UK-based communications consultancy firm known as BTP, under the leadership of Mark Percy, the snazzy Uhuru Ruto 2013 campaign, marked by a newly merged political party, the Jubilee Coalition, celebrated a new story of national unity by critiquing Europe's and America's ongoing interference in Africa. The symbolic figures of the new post-colonial Africa, Kenyatta and Ruto, were made to represent a different story through the Swahili slogan, Tuku Pajama. We are together. And a top trending hashtag Kenya Decides. Through the merger of the names of both leaders, the campaign spearheaded the symbolic unification of historically competing voting blocs to support two leaders now rebranded as leaders to be defended against external forces. Kenya Decides, the hashtag, went viral and was the highest trending hashtag on the continent of the Kenyan 2013 elections period. Adamant about not letting the West interfere, its message spoke to their response to President Obama's warnings about Kenyans electing ICC indictees as the country's leaders. But the refrain prevailed that Kenyans had the right to decide for themselves who their leaders would be. And so what we see that with this icon, Tuko Pajoma, it was deployed as a sign of unity. So it was deployed as a sign of unity between two historically competing parties, and it was translated into 42 tribal languages and signaled the diversity of the governing coalition and the coming together of historically fractured political groups. Invocation of Tuko Pajoma on the campaign train through speeches, utterances, salutations, mobilized grassroots constituencies who prayed and anointed their leaders in defense of what they portrayed as the persecution of Africa's leaders by the ICC. The party's new colors, red, yellow, and black, drew from both Uhuru's National Alliance Party, which was red and white, and Ruto's United Republican Party, yellow and black, and was characterized by two hands being held together and the slogan, "Our fate is in our hands." Now, the Jubilee Coalition's campaign turned the electoral campaign or conversation away from ICC trials and toward the need for a new change-based related agenda that addressed the historical roots of inequality against Kenyans. This message highlighted the violence of the colonial past and the importance of reckoning with the ways that the roots of Kenya's contemporary violence must be understood through a notion of historical time. This compares, of course, with the popularization of the notion of individual criminal responsibility and forms of legal culpability that has long existed in national jurisdictions through various modes of liability, such as aiding and abetting and conspiracy. It also concerns how we understand modes of responsibility within strict conceptualizations of temporality and how that relates to effective responses to international legality. Now, in just setting this up then, because part of what I'm doing here is thinking about two strands of trajectories around which notions of legal time, thus culpability, are understood. On one hand, we have the Rome Statute, Article 28, which in many ways sets the standard for what becomes international, the individualization of criminal responsibility. So, of course, it stipulates that a commander or a person acting as a military commander with effective command and control of his or her forces shall be individually criminally liable for the criminal conduct of his or her subordinates, provided that he or she knew that the forces were committing or about to commit such crimes. Now, this article also covers concerns a commander who fails to take all necessary measures to prevent or suppress the commission of those crimes. The provision requires that the material elements of the crime occur within the temporal jurisdiction of the court. So here we're talking about from July 1st, 2002 onward. And in many ways, it obliges that the crimes be committed with knowledge and intent. And such a doctrine of hierarchical criminal or command responsibility has, of course, its roots in contemporary Europe, established by the Hague Conventions of 1907, and was first applied during the Leipzig war crimes trial after World War II, and later, of course, at Nuremberg. It involves the reassignment of guilt of thousands to a single chief commander and a few top aides. By 1977, the doctrine of command responsibility was accepted as customary international law in particular domains and was codified in additional Protocol 1 to the Geneva Conventions relating to international armed conflicts. And of course, this precedent of individual responsibility has heavily influenced what has ultimately become the formation of late 20th and early 21st century international criminal law. Yet, the challenge is in many ways a classic challenge in liberal philosophical principles in many ways. The idea of individualism as a concept rooted in Western legal tradition stems, of course, from an understanding that a person is only culpable to the extent of his or her own free will or guilty mind, the mens rea, and individual guilt permeates certainly Western legal cultural traditions rather than concepts such as collective guilt or even metaphysical guilt, a notion that a person is guilty simply by being. And in many ways it represents what Antonio Cassese describing the idea behind individualized liability, argued that a defendant ought not to be punished for the acts of others. So in many ways, culpability is the cornerstone of criminal law and refers to the degree to which one can be held responsible for a particular act or set of results. So there should be no surprises there. And in many ways, the idea of notions of individual culpability introduced to international criminal law, of course, at Nuremberg, revived in the 1990s with the ICTY and the ICTR, and then later with the ICC, remains certainly a cornerstone in the emergence of this thing we understand as the rule of law or international criminal law. But collective violence, the problematic as a key feature of international law, has, of course, had consequences. It has meant that prosecutors and international criminal tribunals have to find ways to ascribe liability for collective crimes onto high-ranking leaders. They've grappled with ways to establish the linkages between particular actions of the accused and given sets of acts. The issue concerning how to attribute guilt for collective crimes has of course, proven difficult in international criminal law circles, and amongst various constituencies and publics expected to internalize such principles. And this is at the foreground of what I'm going to unpack today in relation to the African context and the Kenyan case. The difficulties, of course, have centered around liberal legalism and the challenges with advocating for direct criminal responsibility. And in these contexts, legal agents such as the ICC judges and prosecutors also are basing culpability in temporal terms on a post July 1st, 2002 threshold for the ICC's establishment of jurisdiction. Now, this narrow temporal sense of admissible time places responsibility for violence in the hands of those who gave the orders, encouraged violence, or did not prevent it. However, others, of course, in the competing narrative, and much of what dominates so much of my work in East Africa, is that others take a long historical history of colonial and post-colonial injustices into account when assigning guilt for present-day actions. As we shall see in the indictments of Kenya's Uhuru Kenyatta and William Ruto, whose indictments by the ICC cohere with and confirm the perpetrator image, the international characterizations of individual culpability operated in contrast to Kenyan politics. For despite the charges of Ruto and Kenyatta's culpability on the international stage, in 2013, a majority of Kenyans democratically elected Kenyatta and Ruto to be Kenya's president and deputy president. And this democratic election followed, of course, the reign of President Kibaki, who prior to his leadership succeeded Daniel Moi, who ended a 22-year dictatorship. Now, these different assessments for reattributing guilt, what I'll highlight is that they result in what I'm referring to as affective attribution. So here, the attempt to realign culpability in different ways within different domains is being deployed through a sentimentalized discourse used for reattributing meanings of justice through sentimentalized responses to perceived inequality. And so what will follow then is the way that affective attribution, or the affective attribution of culpability, is directly tied to a reattribution of the law's temporality. So I'll show how and why particular sentimental responses to various ICC perpetrators have inspired counter-ICC movements through new modalities for measuring justice as expressed through sentimental reinscriptions of responsibility. Okay. And so I just put that in there for, so in many ways, what's at play are the ways in which people are perceiving this attribution to commanders and rerouting notions of guilt. And at times, certainly assigning guilt, and at other times, rerouting conceptions of guilt. And so in the end, the ICC case against Ruto and Tsang, it's certainly the case against Ruto and Tsang began in September 2013. And many of you know that the case against Uhuru Kenyatta was adjourned until October 2014 and then eventually dismissed. Both sets of cases were beset with controversies and complexities from the beginning, and in many ways highlight the way that public sentiments about culpability of a Kenyan leader were effectively articulated or rearticulated through a different conceptualization of time. Now, in the anthropological literature, conceptions of time in this landscape have certainly been examined through cultural conceptions and constructions, and there's a vast literature on that, and the field has a significant amount to say there. But in many ways, while anthropological questions about the social construction of time connected social meanings of time to its organization, its social life, its cadence, The study of time has predominated anthropological inquiry, certainly, but what we'll see here with this ethnographic study of legal and socio-historical temporality is a dimension that's far more common. My argument here is that not only is it critical for us to understand the emergence of the increasing judicialization of formerly socio-political processes as shifts in the contemporary approaches to rethinking the political, but in studying rule of law formations, global ethnographies must come to terms with the expansion of a particular set of affective questions that speak to the effectiveness of new justice formations as well as their rejections. Through the study of the emergence of the perpetrator figure on the world stage, in many ways we can use that modality to examine the ways that these notions of culpability are imbricated and playing out through effectively vociferous temporalities. Okay, so the ICC's temporality then. Let me just lay out. I'm going to lay out the ICC temporal jurisdiction claims and then try to spend the rest of my talk looking at some of the data that we collected in the Kenyan case. And so what we have here then are particular criminal charges that were laid by the Office of the Prosecutor, the OTP, for the Ruto case. He's charged with murder constituting a crime against humanity, deportation of forcible transfer of the population constituting a crime against humanity, as well as persecution as a crime against humanity. We also have, with the Kenyatta case, the prosecutor versus Uhuru Kenyatta, a number of crimes as well, a murder constituting a crime against humanity, deportation again, rape and other forms of sexual violence constituting a crime against humanity, other inhumane acts constituting a crime against humanity, persecution of as a crime against humanity. And so it's Article 11 of the Rome Statute then that outlines the basis on which temporal jurisdiction is established. So in Article 11, we have the court claiming jurisdiction only with respect to crimes committed after the entry of force of the statute. So we know that it's July 1st, 2002. And so this becomes the critical domain of legality in which, prior to this period, it's not possible to look at contributing factors. Now, so of course the first thing that had to happen was the ICC judges had to examine the court's temporal jurisdiction, and ultimately the specific charges. Now what's interesting is that the temporal jurisdiction was narrowed eventually. So initially the dates were December 31st, 2007 to January 31st, 2008. And then ultimately we had the narrowing of scope that then became January 1st to the 4th, 2008, and this was specifically in relation to violence that in the greater Eldoret region, and this was for the case against Ruto. So very specific and circumscribed temporal period. For the Kenyatta case, of course, the charges were based on his command of murders committed in the Naivasha region January 27th and 28th, and January 24th and 27th. So very, very specific and streamlined periods. Now, of course, it's this temporal basis, because on one hand, there are a different set of questions that are asked, but it's this temporal basis that's at the heart of the rethinking of culpability that interests me here. So in one of the most challenging examples of how courts wrestle with problems of strict temporality can be seen through attempts to address continuing crimes, not necessarily attempts to address crimes that are specific, designated within specific temporal periods, but continuing in composite crimes. And there certainly are interesting but unsatisfactory ways that this is done. Well, what is a continuing and composite crime? What we're talking about here is one, a crime, something designated as a crime that covers an extended period of time, such as, for example, the crime of apartheid. Apartheid, unlike murder, isn't seen as occurring in a single instant. It involves legal policy, state action, social control, and prolonged practices of exclusion and separation. Continuing and composite crimes also include specific discrete acts that by definition must occur over a long time frame. For example, the Rome Statute outlaws murder as a crime against humanity. By definition, to be a crime against humanity, the act of murder must occur as part of a widespread or systematic attack against a civilian population. But in contrast, when addressing regular crimes such as murder, which occur in a discrete temporal instant, courts rarely, if ever, address the importance of temporal limits. And here I'm not suggesting that courts should change, that, you know, don't get me wrong, that I'm not moving in the direction where I'm suggesting that courts should change the temporal basis in and of itself. It's not the point of the argument. Here it's that in many ways what we have is a particular logic in which courts are regularly attempting to address the temporal scope of conduct being prosecuted based on everyone's knowledge of legality, the existence that something is a crime. And there are a number of cases in international law and beyond that have wrestled with these problems of crimes and continuing crimes. One of them, for those law folks in the audience, you'll know the Rainbow Warrior case, the classic case of the Greenpeace ship. And so in this case, there are two French agents convicted by New Zealand for the New Zealand High Court for assisting in the sinking of the Rainbow Warrior ship. This is the Greenpeace ship that's docked off the coast of New Zealand. France refrained from detaining the two agents and returned them to kept them at a French Pacific island where they were meant to serve out their sentence. And of course, France didn't do this at all and in fact removed the men without New Zealand's consent, yet that the agreement was that it would happen with its consent. And of course, the key point in the case law is that the determination or the basis for misconduct was deemed continuous and ongoing. And so in determining the compensation, each day that the agents remained outside of New Zealand's control was the basis on which the men were meant to serve their case. And so this, of course, isn't revolutionary, but it is an attempt in which courts have struggled to deal with the past and to go back to think through these problems around crime. Now, the temporality of crime. And so here I go through, I mean, in the longer paper, I do a reading of a number of cases, U.S. slave ships, there's a case from the ICTR, the jurisprudence, where questions of composite crimes have been dealt with. But ultimately, what we get is limits of the law in relation to temporality, that strict temporality, and that this is there are basic principles of legality, and the challenges around how one deals with ongoing crimes are difficult. Who should be prosecuted is difficult at best. Now, in the case at hand, the case with Kenyatta as well as the prosecutor v. Ruto, let me go over what happens with these cases. So, of course, we have the situation where the Office of the Prosecutor argues that she has reasonable grounds to, or at the time it was Ocampo, that he had reasonable grounds to believe that crimes of murder, rape, other forms of sexual violence, deportation, etc., happened and were attributable to either one of the parties. In the Ruto case, he was alleged to have held a series of meetings in which he distributed money and arms with the goal of commissioning the crimes of murder and displacement of supporters of the PNU. As a result of this, this led to, during the election period, the fomenting of violence following the 2007 elections. Ethnic tensions worsened when, amidst accusations of election rigging and competing parties, the Orange Democratic Movement, the ODM, claimed electoral victory. And so the case is a classic one, that one set of actions led to the other, and again, sort of the typical formulation around electoral violence. Now, with regard to Kenyatta, we have a similar set of questions where the prosecutor alleges that he organized meetings with various government leaders, the police, the leadership of the outlawed Mugiki sect, and that it was in those meetings that he supposedly provided funding, uniforms, and weapons to various pro-PNU youth. And so, of course, in the earlier case with Ruto, the perception is that they're working against the PNU because they don't want them to come into power. And in the case of Kenyatta, it's the pro-PNU that he's providing. And the idea here and part of the narrative is that they're defending their position. And so the idea is that it's not that Kenyatta himself committed these crimes through enacting the crime of violence, but that the crime is attributable to him by having mobilized the support of and for the purposes of, as some say, quote unquote, defending Kikuyu interests, leading the ICC ultimately to consider him criminally responsible for the violence that ultimately the Mungiki were seen as perpetrating. And so we have violence that leads to an outbreak over a period where over 1,000 are killed and many thousands are displaced. The Waki Commission report is released in which ultimately we have the ICC deploying or as a result of the investigation, coming up with a list of those seen as culpable for violence in this moment. And so they were referred to as the Ocampo Six. As a result of the Ocampo Six, so this is, we have two sets of cases, Ruto, Henry Kipruo, and Joshua Tsang. On one side, and of course Tsang being the renowned radio announcer, and then on the other side we have Mathura and Kenyatta, and of course that case has been thrown out. Now, so in the Ruto case, again to clarify, we have a situation where the presumption is that they were developing a criminal plan that was set in place by Ruto. So the idea, of course, is that the mens rea is there's an act in which they've created a network for the purpose of evicting the Kikuyu being the constituency around which Kenyatta is seen to occupy, as well as the Kisii and Kamba communities. And so as a result, he's charged with the charges that you see at the bottom, murder, deportation, et cetera. And then comparably, the criminal charges, as I've said, for Kenya, Mathuro, and Ali, indirect co-perpetration at the time. And so the charges have changed over time, and what we have ultimately is the dropping of the cases for a whole range of questions that we can talk about later. But the key really is, for me, in setting this up in this way, is in thinking about the structure of the modes of liability through which the OTP attempts to set up the case. So the question is, who is criminally responsible for this violence within the strict period? Now, on the end of rethinking the law's temporality then, and rethinking culpability, much of the the work then that I'm going to shift to has to do with many of even the very victims of this post-electoral violence have called into question the designations of criminal responsibility strictly in relation to the assignment of guilt onto the leader. And in many ways, much of the data suggests that, of course, there are questions about histories of land displacement in the first place, as well as a question of politics. So that is proximate actors, like the members of the police, the Mungiki, those who actually engaged in the acts of violence themselves. And I like to tell the story of when doing interviews, we did some focus groups in some of the villages, and I recall a young woman who really, and herself classified herself as a victim of post-election violence. And one of the things that she said when asked is Kenyatta culpable for this violence? Do you think that he should be arrested in The Hague? And her answer, of course, was that no. Every morning I wake up, I see the man who raped my daughter, and I see him with my goat and my chickens and things that don't belong to him, and there's nothing I can do. And in many ways, this kind of narrative repeated over and over again, the politics of proximate actors and the extent to which people in the countryside and in villages, et cetera, were well aware of the proximity of violence and the extent to which they didn't quite buy this reassignment that's part of a 20th century legality that's at play. And so this question, who is responsible for violence, then was very much part of the inquiry, and the responses were deeply emotional and engaged. I'm going to go through just a few of the some of the findings here, and to talk a little bit about the sentimentalism that's at play here around the ways that people wanted to talk about measuring culpability and the ways that they were reassigning and attributing this. So in this case, and I've used pseudonyms here, so in this case we have a man named Kiamu, a human rights advocate, and he says one of the biggest weaknesses of Kenyan criminal law is that we don't have a scheme for compensating victims of crime. And the idea that these people of the 2007 violence are the only victims of crime. They're not the only victims of crime. I'm also a victim of crime. I lost 10 of my teeth. And I should say, as I'm reading, that one of the things that my researchers did, that we did as conducting these interviews, was to document voice responses, emotional responses, the ways in which people use language and the references that they make and the type of emotive appeals. And in this case, of course, this man, you know, he showed us his mouth, he lost 10 of his teeth, and we saw the cadence, the up and down, the emotional manifestation, and it was an insistence, it was an attempt to rearticulate what guilt really was, what justice was, what culpability was. He says, I nearly died. The state isn't compensating me. We've had victims in this country since the colonial times. So if you're going to address the system of victims, and this is where he went up again with his voice, if you're going to, and he pointed at this point, the system of victims of political violence in Kenya, we do it holistically. And then again, loud, we begin with, and then this is the profound moment that we saw often through these narrative tropes, not sent as eloquently, of course, but in this case, we begin with the day the British landed here, the evictions that the settlers did. Today, the biggest landowners are settlers. And then he continues, all of these issues need to be addressed, and he points, we're not going to just come here and create a situation and it becomes an industry for everyone to make money and the reference point becomes 2007. My reference point, and this is another profound moment where he pauses and he speaks loudly, my reference point is the 18th century. I think something needs to happen if we're going to address the question of criminal politics of domination, exploitation, and impoverishment, and eviction. Then my reference point is not 2007, and he says not, N-O, we have capitalized in our inflection notes. It goes much further back. And the ICC is in no capacity, has no capacity to address that, so I'll not waste my time on it. End quote. So here we have not only a strong conviction about the limits of culpability in domestic and international criminal law, we also see a critique concerning the inability of law to adequately address, to adequately encompass historical forms of violence. Despite these other conceptualizations of guilt, which I've spoken about earlier, it's unlikely that the ICC will permit itself to consider activities that can occurred prior to its temporal jurisdiction, thereby violating the basic principles of legality, which I spoke of earlier. And so in many ways, set against this vexed backdrop, who should be held responsible for contemporary crimes of violence and post-election violence? And this was an ongoing refrain and sets of questions that we asked to the, in the many, many focus groups that we did over a period of time, a period of 3 months. So despite this, the articulation, the predominant articulation of culpability by the ICC and deep-seated commitments that supported historical hostilities against warring ethnic groups and parties, public discourses surrounding ICC activity shifted the terms of engagement about justice, in which the measure was increasingly narrated through language that had to do with proximate violence as well as senses of the long historical durée, and this often conceived of in terms of land. So land and the kind of emotive outbursts around land and injustice at times used as a code word for, of course, colonialism, but ultimately its manifestation and the type of post-colonial politics that took play around its redistribution after after independence. And so in this case, we see an example here. I call him John. He's a Kenyan journalist, and he insisted emphatically and quite vociferously that neither Kenya nor Kenyatta nor Ruto were culpable, nor were they the heads of state at the time. In fact, they only announced that they were going to run after they were indicted by the ICC. And so part of what he says here is that it's not clear why over others they would be seen as bearing the most responsibility. So he says, neither of them were running for president. I don't think there was responsibility if you look at the violence and the protest in ODM strongholds. And this is the political party, Ruto's political party. I think you see no Raila, no peace, no Ruto, no peace. So these are the slogans that emerged, and especially in Kalenjin strongholds. So how on earth do you then begin to design these cases against the two of them? So he's, of course, questioning why these two leaders and not others. And he ends this point by saying, I think that it's possible to finger Uhuru Kenyatta for post-election violence in Naivasha and Nakuru, this is in two particular regions. I think that is possible. It is more difficult to connect them to the North Rift. So here, by referring to the slogan, no Raila, no peace, John was explaining that those who supported Raila were fighting for his presidency and not for Ruto's. After the election results and the announcement that Kibaki had won, it became clear that Raila, through the ODM supporters, mostly from what's known as the Luo ethnic group, were not going to be in power. And so here we see the interdynamics around power. And part of what emerged from this interview was one needs to think about what happened in the colonial period that in many ways set in place the politics around land sedimentation, land distribution, and homelessness, displacement, and senses of displacement that ultimately took an ethnic form. So by the time Jomo Kenyatta, so this is Uhuru Kenyatta's father, who was the founding father, the founding leader of the country, and he took office upon independence from the colonial home guards, the British, in 1963. And power in many ways, part of the argument and part of the challenge is that power was seen in from that period to the present, was seen as remaining within a very tightly sealed vacuum in which the Kikuyu and the Kalenjin constituted a small community that governed all others and shielded their political and economic elite from accountability to the people and to the law. And so fundamentally, it's not that people are critical of or are blind to the accusations of dominance and inequality that exist. It's that they also know that this is deeply constituted historically. The violence in 2007 was in many ways seen as a response to the unwillingness of others not to concede their monopolization of power by particular members of the elite, once again, that carried over from the transfer of independence. Yet many blame things like the media, again, for contributing to the production of a concept of the perpetrator responsibility the existence of the Kenya's leader as responsible for post-election violence by depicting the situation as being ultimately about the ethnic Kalenjin, for example, monopolizing against the Kikuyu. And of course, this is state, in many ways, state-shaped media, heavily influenced and heavily regulated. An example of the this next slide, this is a Kenyan, a political analyst who we interviewed in thinking about some of the dimensions of the form of sedimentation that I'm describing, the politics of power and its maintenance within a tight post-independence circle of dominance, which is part of what around which the mobilization of violence took shape. And here we have, and I call him Bornu, he says that some say that the Kalenjin rose up as a community, though it's not true at all. And this is where his voice goes up and he's quite adamant and we see the inflections there, the insistence. And he says, if you go back to reports, and this was quite vivid, he actually had books and things that he brought and that he showed us. He had a pile of documents. And he says, if you go back to the reports of violence, the violence was up and down the railroad line. There was looting and violence in Mombasa. There were Kikuyu and Kisi evictions in Maasai land. There was no violence in the central highlands, but Nairobi and going all the way over to the border. So the idea that the Kalenjin were some atavistic, bloodthirsty people. Others just serve to demonize them. Atavistic, bloodthirsty others just serve to demonize them. The ignorance about the Kalenjin was mind-blowing, and here he exclaimed, I mean, the Kalenjin were organized so effectively, but when you talk to people in Nakuru or the Kikuyus who had family or whatever in Nakuru, there was a point at which the Kalenjin were invading, and there was just utter fear. And so part of here, the narrative that emerges here when people are trying to explain a counter-narrative is the way that fear works, the type of narrativization of the other as mobilizing against another ethnic group. So there are ways in which the discourse then serves to produce and produce particular ends. Okay, so moving along, so I've said a little bit about the, to summarize these three, the Kiamu, John, and Bornu, as representatives and in many ways manifestations of much of the data that we collected, what they show us in many ways is that affective reinscriptions of guilt are at the heart of these sentiments that are at play. The ICC's focus on command responsibility for many of them overlooks the guilt of those who actually engaged in criminal conduct, And in the Kenyan case, it produced a framework in which the cases were argued in a way that overlooked the temporality of collective responsibility for age-old political problems. And this idea of the collective or collectivities, of course, is often articulated through these segmented ethnic formations. Now, the history is an important one, and the land division is quite important here. I don't have time to go through that, but in many ways, the popular narrative around the lack of the introduction of the willing buyer, willing seller program. We see that in a number of African regions where upon independence, those with the resources to buy back land from which they were displaced because they didn't have title are given that opportunity, but in fact only those who worked in some cases for the colonial guard were in positions to do that. And so the recognition of the type of historical injustices around land as a manifestation of violence and violence that takes an ethnic form is clearly articulated in the ways that people talk about both Kenyan post-colonial politics as well as what is often known as the Mount Kenya Mafia. And so the Kenyatta family, the family that acquired immense wealth and power in Kenya's post-colonial period, and that of course made matters worse when those who were displaced from land were deemed as foreigners. And so what we see then, and we see this throughout in many regions in the continent, the politics of a historical past that leads to forms of displacement that have a particular manifestation, and that people are well aware that manifestation is present through different forms, and of course one of them being the ethnic form. Now, in a speech that Kenyatta makes, a key speech, I'm not going to go through all of it, I'm going to just read a few lines from it, but in a key speech, in many ways, one of the profound speeches that he made when he announced his candidacy and the merger of the two parties with Ruto, he says that ultimately, he starts by saying, we all know that when the colonial government established himself in Kenya, it created three categories of land ownership. He first was the land taken by the colonial government for its own use, which was called crowned land. Second, the land given to the settlers as private land. And lastly, what remained was assigned to Africans as native reserves. And he goes on in this quite profound and well-written speech by, of course, his press agents. In doing that, in fact, what he puts forward is his plan, his electoral plan. And the plan was all about land redistribution. It was about the colonial past, the sedimentation, the forms of injustices, and how his government was going to rectify it through the coming together of these parties and an attempt to deal with these challenges once and for all. And the type of emotive signification, I mean, much of this we collected in much of our work in the ways that the responses by the audience, the ways that particular topical arenas were taken up and issues of time and justice were interwoven to reconceptualize and reassign culpability through these other dimensions. Okay, so what I've explored here and much of the data here what I've explored here is what the responses to the ICC's designation of culpability tell us about the way that perpetrators of legal time and histories of the colonial past and post-colonial degradation shape ethical horizons for Western legality. Particular sentimentalized judgments are deployed to undermine post-2002 linear determinants of legality by which particular leaders and not foot soldiers, for example, or perhaps not the police or members of gangs like the Mungiki are indicted by the ICC, but in fact are deemed culpable for violence. Sentimentality in anthropology has asserted its presence by attempting to understand the embodiment of emotions through the domain of the social. This chapter in many ways makes visible particular social manifestations of affect through processes of reattributing culpability from the figure of the individual perpetrators to greater collectivities, including colonial authorities and members of the postcolonial statecraft. My intervention here is concerned with the imbrication of the social and the intersubjective as they relate to histories of coloniality, post-coloniality, and contemporary Pan-Africanist formations. Nationalist sentiments as senses of emotion about a people, their history, and their place in the world are visible when those feelings are embodied through speech acts, ritual practices, voting behavior, popular campaigns, and so forth, and articulated through particular cultural lenses, such as our senses of judgment, capacities for making decisions, or our moral sources. As embodied thought, sentiments animate cognition in ways that make interpretation, thus sociality, visible and meaningful according to various sociocultural rules. It's okay. One of the larger questions in affect theory has been whether human action gains meaning from an interior pre-social process, or whether and how it gains meaning through social processes that produce meaning. The prevailing biopsychological literature on affect theory suggests that affects are pre-social and they exist before human intentions and subjective beliefs. They are pre-subject forces that involve autonomic, non-cognitive processes that influence our judgments, but that exist below human consciousness. On the other hand, other scholars interested in physiological and cognitive aspects of affect argue that cognition is repressed from action through theorizing affects as arrangements by which bodies transform neurological processes into products of eventual human action. They argue that affects have more to do with social effects of brain functions rather than being exclusive about human biology alone. Such scholars of cognition, such as, for example, Brian Masumi, have characterized affects by examining states of intensity that are nonlinear and unpredictable and are seen as being open to creative potential. They explore understanding material brain functions and neurological interactions as related to their products, potentialities that shape social meaning. Clearly, there's a gap between biological processes and the cognitive and psychosocial processes that shape social meaning-making. The core of this gap has to do with interiorities, such as intention, and those processes manifest in exteriorities, such as emotions or sentiments. Affects that emanate from post-violence contexts may indeed reflect neurological and bodily brain functions, but as I've shown, as emotions, they are manifestations of social processes. Such an approach to affect allows us to explore the role that introspection and social feeling play in shaping how people come to conceptualize sentiments around pro-accountability or pro-retributive justice within and outside of legality. As I demonstrate by way of examining these attributive processes, sentiments as manifestations of emotion have histories of meaning that represent diverse things to various scholars in varying fields. From detached pre-social responses to socially produced emotions, the term is deeply rooted in our ways of organizing ourselves in relation to the world. Sentimentality in anthropology has asserted its presence by attempting to understand the embodiment of emotions through the domain of the social. It has been concerned with the imbrication of the social and the intersubjective as they relate to histories of coloniality, post-coloniality, and the contemporary contemporary Pan-Africanist formations. The goal here in this paper, this chapter, follows the call for the development of robust ethnographic accounts of how human emotions are socially produced. The processes at play have to do with exploring what Kenyan responses to the ICC's legal designations of culpability tell us about the way that perceptions of legal time and histories of colonial and post-colonial degradation shape ethical and ethnic horizons for Western legality. I've shown how particular judgments were deployed to undermine post-2002 linear determinants of legality by which particular leaders and not the foot soldiers are deemed culpable for violence. By reinscribing culpability through the longue durée of colonial violence, sentiments about structure and violence shape the problem space of culpability as socially charged designations. And ultimately, it lays bare the problem of legal time through which particular emotional responses take a social form. Though not new to legal anthropology, the notion of legal time is scarcely interrogated in Western jurisprudential circles, particularly with regard to differences in international law and certainly in criminal law. Continuing crimes, as I've said, in many ways creates less stable assertions about who is a perpetrator and creates multivalent dilemmas. And these dilemmas, of course, involve questions of jurisdiction, admissibility, and even evidence. And they further complicate the parameters by which affective reattribution is operable in justice conceptualizations. For while the question of who is responsible for violence against those victimized raises questions of how one is to measure such forms of culpability, the reality is that a range of responses are imbricated with the figure of the African perpetrator and call on us to clarify ethnographically what the realm of the social can tell us about contemporary social processes around which notions of time, for example, are understood and responses to it registered. When we turn to the campaigns, another dimension in which there is significant popular engagement, on one hand, we see the popular call for justice through the demand of the perpetrator. This is in the earlier Kony 2012 campaign, and in many ways representing a first level of social activism in which the root causes of violence are erased. The demand to rethink the culpability of law's perpetrator through rethinking legal time instead is what I characterize as reattributive. It opens a lens onto understanding the way that contemporary publics are increasingly engaged through these justice campaigns, but it is a space of contestation and redirecting of appropriate tropes or narratives that are reflective of what people understand to be justice in relation to the ideal type of culpable individual, that is, perpetrator. What these campaigns suggest is that while some narratives of culpability are effective because they're aligned with predominant articulations of culpability, others, when examined in relation to real-world lived experiences, are embodied and understood differently. In this case, the imagery of the Kenyatta and Ruto as perpetrator to be made accountable to law is popularly examined in relation to a different conception of time. It's not a post-2002 temporal jurisdiction that's at play. It's a sense of historical time, colonial time, mass culpability that has set in motion the forms of segmentation that we see today. The reattributions of culpability reveal the difference between social and legal justice and varying understandings of guilt and responsibility as affective manifestations. Through these affectivities, we see how fraught with meaning the assignment of culpability to one perpetrator is seen as being, especially in contexts in which postcolonial states have failed to adequately address the needs of those seen as being victimized by violence. And while the reattributions of time and culpability represent a difference based on proximate violence, or because of an inability to reconcile contemporary violence in relation to guilt attributed within a strictly narrow temporal period, for example, the 2007-08 period that I spoke of, the reality is that in the Kenyan political landscape, people reattribute the meaning of legal time for the individualization of criminal responsibility does not account for the deep histories that produce the conditions under which police violence, for example, ethnic rivalries, and land dispossession were made viable or possible. Rather, there's a realization that the inscriptions of power in colonial Kenya were central to the play of power in the post-colonial independence period. Since independence, power has never been balanced or distributed among many of those and other ethnic groups that inherited the beyond those ethnic groups, so that is the Kalenjin and the Kikuyu, that inherited the control of the statecraft after the British left. Indeed, the failure to balance power historically in post-colonial Kenya, set alongside the use of the law to rectify histories of dispossession manifest in acts of violence, reflect the afterlife of the colonial project. In post-colonial Africa, the afterlife of imperialism, colonialism, and the violence of dispossession persists deeply in the psychic minds of the psychic life of social justice. Alongside historically constituted ethnic divisions, there's also an awareness of the ways that imperial injustices remain part of the post-colonial reality, a continuity of structures of economic, legal, and political power. And while the image of the perpetrator as warlord and killer has been constructed through the law to produce a narrative of the merciless mercenary, the African head of state as perpetrator has been subject to another moral imaginary that represents a new shift in the consolidation of Pan-African alliances, and especially those that we saw around what was conceptualized and resignified as the new Kenya, speaking to the West, you know, as per the image of Barack Obama. So to end then, the Kenyan cases being pursued by the ICC demonstrate this point. What they show us is that the sentimental aspirations produced through reattribution of culpability from an African leader to a particular historical moment can actually be explained through affective sentiments of solidarity, in which not only do Africans want to end violence, impunity, and abuses of the post-colonial elite, but they also want to reassert, many of them, a new narrative about the socio and historical and political nature of contemporary violence. The Jubilee victory of 2007 and the Jubilee victory of 2013 demonstrates how social justice can exceed the strictly juridical, and how pre-social affects are manifest in fundamentally social affectivities. Today, we're seeing the emergence of a different moral imaginary through their respective communities, in which there's a socio-cultural realization that particular historical attachments reflect the reality that we live in a world that extends beyond the law. So at a time when the judicialization of issues previously managed through formal political processes has expanded with class action suits, reparations, alien torts claims, at a time when symbolic apologies and the expansion of global governance mechanisms are at large, affective rearticulations of time and space and the recalibration of justice could not be more important. Today, demands for justice are not just about moral demands for prosecutorial convictions. Prosecutorial justice is only one norm development that's playing out in particular tenets of justice assemblages. We're not seeing the deployment of a blind faith in legality. Rather, there exists a recognition that contemporary African mass violence often manifests in election contests, struggles over power, land, patronage preferences, requires a rethinking of the socio-political dimensions of time and space through which the substance of the legitimacy of legality is recalibrated. The popular support for Kenyatta and Ruto and their election to the presidency and deputy presidency represents not a statement of their fitness as presidents, but an affective expression by Kenyan people of their appeal as creating avenues for reconciling a colonial past constituted on the basis for Kenya's post-election violence. This presence in many ways and this figure of the Ruto Kenyatta party has shaped perception, emotional responses, inclination, and dreams. It is imbricated with dominant tropes and rubs uncomfortably against them. It is contradictory and shifting, but emanates from historical manifestations of modernity's past. these contours of affective reattribution as a product of the contemporary moment produces the conditions for the possible, the viable, and in many cases, the believable. And ultimately, it sets in place a modality by which the potential to have the past and its psychosocial remnants reinscribed in the making of contemporary publics is a key characteristic of what I'm seeing in many ways as the anti-ICC pushback. Thank you.